collection of sacred hymns that may date as far back as 1500 BCE. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, a treatise on Atman composed around 700 BCE, neatly summarizes the concept. He is never seen, but is the witness. He is never heard, but is the hearer. He is never thought, but is the thinker. He is never known, but is the knower. There is no other witness but him, no other hearer but him, no other thinker but him, no other knower but him. He is the eternal ruler, your own immortal self. The Vedic priests taught that if a human being managed through the disciplines of yoga to strip away their selfish, egotistical urges, their crude, lowercase self, they would be left with pure awareness, the witness of their every thought and sensation, their true self. Crucially, this entity was eternal, unchanging, and indistinguishable from the supreme soul. Throughout human history, spiritual seekers of all kinds have reached similar conclusions about the importance of apprehending self. In ancient Greece, the maxim, "Know thyself," was inscribed in stone at the temple of Apollo in Delphi. The God of the Old Testament, speaking to Moses out of the burning bush, declared his name to be, "I am that I am." Christian Gnostics believe that only by investigating the self could one find God. And in Sufism, the secret soul or Rusir was conceived as a direct connection to the divine. To comprehend the self was to understand the supreme divinity, the ultimate I am. In ancient India, there were yogins who were convinced they could discern their very self during the deepest stages of meditation. The author of the Bhagavad Gita wrote that when meditation had been mastered, the mind was unwavering like the flame of a lamp in a window place. In the still mind, in the depths of meditation, the self reveals itself. Beholding the self by means of the self, an aspirant knows the joy and peace of complete fulfillment. With persistence, the writer says, the yogin could achieve unity with the source of all existence. Wherever the mind wanders, restless and diffuse in its search for satisfaction without, lead it within. Train it to rest in the self. Abiding joy comes to those who still the mind, freeing themselves from the taint of self-will. With their consciousness unified, they become one with Brahman. Accordingly, the Brahmins envisaged the self as a spiritual being living within the corporeal being that was indivisible, unchanging, and beyond suffering. But when Siddhartha investigated the five components or aggregates of human existence one by one, our physical form, feelings, perceptions, volitions, and consciousness, in other words, the entirety of a person, he discovered that every single one was ultimately beyond our control, impermanent, and therefore unsatisfactory. Each was bound up with suffering. You could believe there was something else, an ethereal spirit or soul disconnected from every other known mental and physical phenomenon, but that would be purely a matter of faith. In Siddhartha's opinion, it was a delusion. He had spent 6 years refining the skills needed to investigate his own mind, matching or exceeding those of anyone else alive. Through mindfulness meditation, he had searched long and hard but encountered nothing that met the minimum requirements to justify the appellation Atman, his eternal, unchanging self. His subsequent teaching of non-self was not a trivial claim, because without access to a self, how could one hope to commune with the universal I am, Brahman? When you ceased to believe in the self, the sacred bridge that linked humanity to the divine vanished like a mirage, and with it any hope of channeling its power, as the Brahmins claimed to do through their fiery sacrifices. Intimations that the soul does not exist are not unique to Buddhism, though they are nearly always considered incompatible with religious faith. This would prove treacherous terrain for the anonymous Christian author of The Cloud of Unknowing, who believed that during the meditation one could reach out and become perfectly united to God while still here on earth. He wrote that the sinful self was a source of great sorrow, a foul, stinking lump that must always be hated and despised. Wouldn't it be better to deny its very existence? The writer seems to have been on the brink of reaching the same conclusion as Siddhartha before recoiling from it in horror. Yet in all this sorrow, the soul does not desire not to exist, for that would be diabolical madness and contempt for God. But it is well pleased to exist, and offers heartfelt thanks to God for the excellent gift of existence, even though it desires unceasingly to lack for knowledge and feeling of its existence. Aside from this theological trepidation, there was a psychological barrier to accepting the concept of non-self. The Buddha taught that while each of us is simply an aggregation of elements in a state of constant flux, our clinging or attachment to them, our identification with them, gives rise to suffering and the delusion of selfhood. According to this view, a human being is a process without any fixed center. The 20th century translator and scholar Eknath Iswaran, an expert in the philosophies of ancient India, compared the five aggregates that Buddhists believe comprise a person to the brightly coloured spices one buys in the marketplace before taking them home to grind and combine for that night's dinner. Thus, from moment to moment, each of us is no more than a unique blend of spices, a homemade garam masala. Surely you may be thinking there must be more to me than that. To be human is to have a sense of owning one's sensations, thoughts, feelings, and urges. We intuitively believe there is a thinker behind our thoughts, a hearer behind what we hear, a viewer behind what we see. We have the sense of being an operator inside our own skulls, looking out at the world through our eyes and calling the shots. If that were really true, a human being would be little different from the jewellery shop owner Rosenberg in the movie Men in Black, who carries around an extraordinary secret within his head. When this grey-haired, bespectacled jeweller winds up in a hospital mortuary after being killed in a fight, agents J and K quickly discover that he was no more than an elaborate machine built to look like a human, operated by a diminutive alien, a homunculus, who sits inside his cockpit-like skull, pulling levers with his tiny hands and pushing little pedals with his feet. You might wonder, quite reasonably, whether there could be another homunculus operating the alien. Is there an even smaller creature sitting inside his head, and so on ad infinitum? The trouble with the idea of an inner controller, who runs our lives through the exercise of free will, is that it presupposes there can be actions without prior causes, which is impossible. And yet that is what we continually tell ourselves must be happening. In the 18th century, the philosopher David Hume reached the same conclusion that Siddhartha Gautama had in the 5th century BCE. If any impression gives rise to the idea of self, that impression must continue invariably the same throughout the whole course of our lives, since self is supposed to exist after that manner. But there is no impression constant and invariable. Pain and pleasure, grief and joy, passions and sensations succeed each other and never all exist at the same time. It cannot therefore be from any of these impressions or from any other that the idea of self is derived. And, consequently, there is no such idea. For my part, when I enter most intimately into what I call myself, I always stumble on some particular perception or other of heat or cold, light or shade, love or hatred, pain or pleasure. I never can catch myself at any time without a perception, and never can observe anything but the perception. I may venture to affirm of the rest of mankind that they are nothing but a bundle or collection of different perceptions which succeed each other with an inconceivable rapidity and are in a perpetual flux and movement. To assert that the self does not exist was certainly considered revolutionary in the Buddha's day, and it will still strike many modern readers as peculiar. But it is important to understand that Siddhartha was not denying the experience of selfhood, which is perfectly real. It is our stream of consciousness. But the thoughts, emotions, and memories that comprise it come and go. Our bodies and minds change. Even consciousness waxes and wanes throughout the day and while we are asleep. Our components are in a constant state of flux. The mind is a kind of theatre, said Hume, where several perceptions successively make their appearance, pass, repass, glide away, and mingle in an infinite variety of postures and situations. In Buddhist terminology, the aggregates, form, feelings, perceptions, volitions, and consciousness, are conditioned. They are being carried along in a stream of causes and effects. The goal of mindfulness is to resist our natural tendency to cling to them, and instead step out of the stream and simply watch them go by. Only then can we see through the illusion of selfhood created when the mind identifies with the flotsam of consciousness. What you're left with isn't nothing, annihilation, but knowing. The Pali word Buddha can be translated as one who knows. This knowing is, of course, only possible as a result of consciousness, which remains something of a scientific mystery. Crucially, however, its operation is not dependent on our having an internal controller, a soul, or self. For Buddhists, to internalize the teaching of non-self, anatta in Pali, has a remarkable consequence. It starts to break down distinctions between you and me, or us and them. Because when the proud, egotistical self is taken out of the picture, these differences blur and the sense of alienation we might once have felt begins to dissolve. This change in perspective also loosens the grip of jealousy and possessiveness, rendering the difference between yours and mine unimportant. Like many people, when I first came across the teaching of non-self, I concluded that Buddhists are nihilists bent on becoming shaved-headed, impassive automata. But the abbot of Amaravati Monastery, Ajahn Amaro, quickly put me straight. It's about recognizing that the boundaries of I and me and mine are convenient fictions, he told me during our interview. We were sitting in the study of his bungalow-like kuti overlooking a tiny walled garden. I was surprised to see the unmistakable face of the Dalai Lama beaming down at us. It felt like finding a painting of the Pope hanging on the Archbishop of Canterbury's wall, but was further evidence that Buddhists do things a little differently. The abbot was sitting at his desk on which I had placed my recorder for the interview. He was in full flow, only occasionally pausing to take a sip from a mug. "You call this your recording device," he said, pointing at the machine. "But if it falls out of your pocket and you leave it on the tube, it's not yours anymore. The idea or the memory lingers, but the object is no longer yours." I reflexively checked whether its red light was lit, indicating that it was still recording all this. Anatta, non-self, is a recognition that this being cannot be divorced from everything else. We're constantly breathing air in and breathing air out, eating food, excreting, living in interrelationship with the whole world, both material and mental, biological and physical. There's an unrelenting exchange and interrelationship. But it's not like saying, I don't exist. I'm a Buddhist, I'm supposed to believe I don't exist. That's a common misunderstanding. It's a bit like saying... He swept his arm across the desk to illustrate the point and knocked his mug flying, sending a shower of brown fizzy liquid everywhere, Whoops! I rescued my recorder from the puddle in which it was now sitting. Do you want to test it to see if it's still going? He said, clearly concerned. It's still going, I replied optimistically, checking the light. It was just a few drops. The monk went into the adjoining room and brought back some paper towels. So, technically, that was my drink, he said jokingly. Now it's not any more. We're going to get wet feet. He got down on his knees to swab the floor, and from this position continued where he had left off. It's also kind of interesting. Someone was telling me last year how Freud coined the word ego without the idea of it being some sort of fixed, separate entity or quality. He was merely using the Latin word as a way to talk about the feeling of I am. A shorthand for the I feeling, which is very comparable to the Buddhist approach. He went to the other room for more paper towels without breaking his flow. As part of our experience, that word is applicable. I am speaking, I am here, I am feeling. But when that word is imputed with absolute reality, a distinctness that's making it separate from the rest of the world, then there's trouble. Buddhists believe that to realize this truth, that you are not yourself, is immensely liberating. And so by the time the Buddha had finished speaking after delivering this second lesson to the 5 monks in the deer park, the scriptures say there were now 6 arahants, fully enlightened beings, in the world. With the teaching of non-self, alongside the teachings about suffering and impermanence, they had realized Nibbana. They were free from all worldly attachments and the taints of craving, aversion, and delusion. The Pali word Nibbana means literally to be snuffed out. But it was their egos that had been extinguished, not their personalities. Spiritual enlightenment is often portrayed in these Buddhist stories as coming suddenly like a bolt of lightning. The progress of scientific enlightenment over the past 500 years has been rather more sedate, but no less dramatic, dealing a series of humiliating blows to the human ego. In the 16th and 17th centuries, Copernicus, Kepler, and Galileo managed to figure out that Earth is not the center of the universe. In the 19th century, Darwin proposed that all creatures had evolved through natural selection from a simple common ancestor, and that humans were just another kind of ape. In the 20th century, we learned that our sun is an insignificant star among the 100 billion stars in the Milky Way, which is just one of around 170 billion galaxies in the known universe. In the early years of the 21st century, astronomers have concluded that many, if not most, of these other galaxies contain habitable planets, some of which may be home to more advanced civilizations than our own. To cap it all, we have to listen to scientists and philosophers questioning whether we humans have free will, let alone a self. In his book Chance and Necessity, French molecular biologist and Nobel Prize winner Jacques Monod reflected upon our species' perennial struggle to maintain its special status in the universe, despite growing evidence to the contrary. We would like to think ourselves necessary, inevitable, ordained from all eternity. All religions, nearly all philosophies, and even a part of science testify to the unwearying, heroic effort of mankind desperately denying its own contingency. Perhaps it gives us a sense of security, a sense of belonging in much the same way that a child needs a secure, nurturing environment to develop a strong sense of self while growing up. Ajahn Amaro uses the metaphor of an embryonic bird inside its protective shell to make an important distinction between this vital stage in our early lives and the stage when we are sufficiently mature to break out of our shells and confront the real world. At first, it will seem deeply counterintuitive, but it gets easier. The notion that inside each human head is a pilot, an unchanging, indivisible self like the aliens sitting in Rosenberg's skull, is very convincing until you start to notice how that experience of selfhood changes not just over a lifespan, but from moment to moment, from hour to hour, and from day to day. Notice how the feeling of being you changes according to whether you have drunk your morning coffee, how well you slept, how full your stomach is, whether you were feeling distracted, irritated, bored, worried, or elated. If you are anything like me, the experience of selfhood never stays the same from one minute to the next. Now recall how it felt to be you at the last office Christmas party with your colleagues, when you were sitting eating Christmas dinner with your family, a week later, on New Year's Eve at a party with friends. Did you feel and behave like the same person on each of these occasions? Which one was the real you? Perhaps you took a brief holiday before returning to work in the new year. What was it like to be you relaxing on a beach with just the sound of the waves, perhaps reading a novel to take you out of yourself? Of course, each of us has distinctive personality traits, but even these vary according to the circumstances. Our place on the spectrum from shy introversion to uninhibited extroversion, for example, will vary according to the setting, the people we're around, how well we know them and our relationship to them, whether we have had a drink, our alertness, how happy we feel at that particular moment. We hear expressions like, "She was not herself," all the time to justify some indiscretion. But when are we ever our true selves? The last refuge of the self, perhaps, is physical continuity. Despite the body's mercurial nature, it feels like a badge of identity we have carried since the time of our earliest childhood memories. A thought experiment, dreamed up in the 1980s by British philosopher Derek Parfit, illustrates how important, yet deceiving, this sense of physical continuity is to us. He invites us to imagine a future in which the limitations of conventional space travel, of transporting the frail human body to another planet at relatively slow speeds, have been solved by beaming all the data needed to assemble a person to their destination, encoded in radio waves. You step into a machine resembling a photo booth, called a teletransporter, which logs every atom in your body, then sends the information at the speed of light to a replicator on Mars, say. This rebuilds your body atom by atom using local stocks of carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and so on. Unfortunately, the high energies needed to scan your body with the required precision vaporize it. But that's okay, because the replicator on Mars faithfully reproduces the structure of your brain nerve by nerve, synapse by synapse. You step into the teletransporter, press the green button, and an instant later, materialize on Mars, and can continue your existence where you left off. The person who steps out of the machine at the other end not only looks just like you, but etched into his or her brain are all your personality traits and memories, right down to the memory of eating breakfast that morning and your last thought before you pressed the green button. If you are a fan of Star Trek, you may be perfectly happy to use this new mode of space travel, since this is more or less what the USS Enterprise's transporter does when it beams its crew down to alien planets and back up again. But now Parfit asks us to imagine that a few years after you first used the teletransporter comes the announcement that it has been upgraded in such a way that your original body can be scanned without destroying it. You decide to give it a go. You pay the fare, step into the booth, and press the button. Nothing seems to happen, apart from a slight tingling sensation, but you wait patiently, and sure enough, 45 minutes later, an image of your new self pops up on the video link, and you spend the next few minutes having a surreal conversation with yourself on Mars. Then comes some bad news. A technician cheerfully informs you that there have been some teething problems with the upgraded teletransporter. The scanning process has irreparably damaged your internal organs. So whereas your replica on Mars is absolutely fine and will carry on your life where you left off, this body here on Earth will die within a few hours. Would you care to accompany her to the mortuary? How do you feel? There is no difference in outcome between this scenario and what happened in the old scanner. There will still be one surviving you, but now it somehow feels as though it's the real you facing the horror of imminent annihilation. Parfit nevertheless uses this thought experiment to argue that the only criterion that can rationally be used to judge whether a person has survived is not the physical continuity of a body, but psychological continuity, having the same memories and personality traits as the most recent version of yourself. Buddhists have formulated what is essentially a theory of individual psychological continuity. Called dependent origination, it envisages a causal chain of events whereby someone's motives and actions and the associated karma determine what happens to them as their life unfolds. See Figure 8, page 282. The chain is pictured as extending beyond death, affecting rebirth into a future life and a different physical body in a way not dissimilar from an interplanetary teletransporter. Many Buddhists believe that the karma resulting from their attitudes and behaviors in this life will determine their fate in this future existence, and some even claim to remember past lives. The Buddhist concept of rebirth is controversial. I'll return to it in the final chapter, but few would quibble with the idea that what we do today can affect our lives further down the line. If you take up smoking, for example, your older self will have to face the consequences. Given the opportunity, they'd likely chide their younger self. The trouble is that young people can barely conceive that they will ever be old, leading them to take chances with their health or safety. The younger and older selves don't see eye to eye, and the supposedly indivisible self is divided against itself across time. But different parts of the brain can also come into conflict about lifestyle choices, even to the extent where there appear to be two or more selves battling for control. One of its hemispheres might be in favor of smoking while the other is vehemently against. Our brains resolve such conflicts without our noticing, yet they become very apparent, for instance, in a woman who developed alien hand syndrome after a stroke damaged her corpus callosum, the bundle of fibers that links the right and left hemispheres of the brain and normally coordinates their activity. Researchers observed her putting a cigarette between her lips with her right hand, controlled by the left hemisphere, only for her left hand, controlled by the left hemisphere, to take it out and throw it away before the right hand could light it. "I guess he doesn't want me to smoke that cigarette," the patient observed wryly. People with alien hand syndrome swear they don't have any influence over what the rogue hand gets up to. It's as if another independent self is in control of it. Other split brain effects can be caused by an operation to prevent epileptic seizures that was pioneered in the 1960s by neurobiologists Roger Sperry and Ronald Myers. It involves severing the corpus callosum and works like a firebreak in a blazing forest, stopping the spread of uncontrolled electrical activity from one side of the brain to the other. But it also curtails normal communication between the two hemispheres. People who have had the operation can appear perfectly normal, showing no noticeable change in temperament, personality, or intelligence, and no difficulty in social situations. But on closer examination, something extraordinary becomes apparent. Thanks to the division of labor between the two halves of a brain, researchers have been able to investigate the consequences of severing the communication link. The left hemisphere processes sensory inputs from the right side of the body, receiving visual information from the right eye, for example, and controls voluntary movements on that side, whereas the right hemisphere is in charge of the other side of the body, In addition, the left hemisphere specializes in reading and speech, whereas the right hemisphere has only rudimentary language abilities. For instance, when researchers show a picture of a spoon to a patient's left eye only and ask her what she can see, she will deny being able to see anything at all. But when asked to reach behind a partition with her left hand and feel around for the thing she did not see among a variety of objects, she will pick up a spoon. When asked to say what the object is in her hand, she will be unable to name or describe it. Other studies of patients whose corpus callosum has been severed demonstrate that the two hemispheres can learn things independently of each other, and they have separate memories and competing motivations. One side of the brain can know something that the other is completely unaware of, and one side can be opposed to the actions of the other. To all intents and purposes, each hemisphere is now hosting its own stream of consciousness. There are now two selves operating out of the same head. It's as if agents J and K were to open up Rosenberg's skull and find a pair of aliens sitting side by side. Split-brain patients dispel any notion that inside each of us is an unchanging, indivisible self, an inner controller sitting in splendid isolation, pulling our body's levers. The two hemispheres are one source of division, another is that between the primitive emotional parts of the brain and the more recently evolved regions. There is a constant tug of war between the fearful, angry animal inside all of us and the more intellectual being who worries about long-term consequences. Our brains also contain opposing networks of regions that vie with each other to determine whether our minds are focused on an external task or engaged in internally directed thoughts. On the basis of all this evidence, neuroscientist David Eagleman of Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas, has proposed that we should view the brain not as a single, unified system, but as a team of rivals squabbling among themselves. Often we are not even aware of these rivalries until a stroke or brain surgery exposes them. I'm reminded of the ingenious Disney Pixar animation Inside Out, which depicts a team of five operators at the controls inside a little girl's head. Joy, sadness, anger, fear, and disgust, who have very different ideas about how she should behave. While our five basic emotions are not generated by distinct parts of the brain operating in isolation, we can recognize how they compete for control over our lives. Amid all this internal confusion and rivalry, how can we know ourselves at all? How do we remember from day to day what kind of person we are? Proud, sensitive, obstinate, vivacious, shy? Toward the end of my stay at the monastery, I attended a meditation class where a young monk suggested we should ask ourselves, "Who am I?" without expecting any answer. It's the kind of mental exercise Buddhists enjoy. When I got home, I asked my smartphone the same question. The reply came back, "You're asking me, James?" It then displayed my address and telephone numbers. I rephrased the question, "What am I?" Within milliseconds, the phone responded, "Human." Is there a part of the brain where the sense of selfhood is generated? Not your species name or contact details, but what you are like. In the past, some neuroscientists claimed there was nothing special about the way brain handled such information, arguing that how we remember things about ourselves is no different from the way we remember things about anything. Pop singers, popsicles, popes. It's just that we're much more familiar with us than with anything else in the world. However, recent research has identified a part of the brain that specializes in reporting to consciousness not only the kind of people we are, but also how we relate to those around us. Scientists at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, tracked down this activity of the brain in 2002 by asking people to respond to a series of adjectives describing personality traits such as dependable, polite, and talkative while they lay in an MRI scanner. They were told to respond in one of three ways to each word. Does the adjective describe you, self? Does the adjective describe the current US President George Bush, other? And is the adjective in uppercase letters, case? When they were asked whether the adjective applied to them, it caused increased activity in the volunteers' medial prefrontal cortex compared with when they were asked other or case questions. Subsequent research has confirmed this finding and singled out adjacent areas including the cingulate cortex, which fire up not only during self-reflection, but also when we're intuiting what others are thinking. This suggests that the same parts of the brain simulate both the feeling of self and how it feels to be somebody else. In other words, empathy. So it makes sense that the more difficulty that people on the autism spectrum have intuiting the thoughts and motivations of others, the less sense of their own self they have. What's more, this diminishing sense of selfhood and worsening social ability seems to correlate with weaker activation in the cingulate cortex of their brains. Neuroscientists often refer to these neighboring regions as a single unit, the cortical midline structures, or CMS. They are found on the inner surface of each hemisphere, hence the adjective medial. See figure 3 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. If you were to take a human brain and pry apart the two hemispheres to expose their inner faces, like opening up a sandwich to inspect the filling, you would be looking at the CMS of each. In a sense, the brain is an ego sandwich. Evidence is growing that the CMS are core components of the brain's self-app. They not only access autobiographical memory and the relatively stable aspects of our personality, but also somehow bond these to important stimuli in our social and physical environment, thus creating a sense of me and others. This has led some researchers to speculate that the sense of self is simply a byproduct of a system that evolved to help us relate to other people. I explore some surprising implications of this in Chapter 9, The Fall. But it's worth noting here that two areas of the CMS that light up when people are asked to reflect about their own personality, the medial prefrontal cortex and posterior cingulate cortex, are proportionally bigger in humans than in any other primate. They are also well connected with each other, leading some neuroscientists to propose that the posterior cingulate cortex interfaces between us and the outside world by gauging the personal and emotional importance of stimuli, while the medial prefrontal cortex is where this information interfaces with consciousness. I asked Judson Brewer, a psychiatrist and mindfulness researcher at Yale University School of Medicine and the University of Massachusetts Medical School, to explain how the two regions might work together to create this feeling of self. One theory is that the medial prefrontal cortex is a hub of the conceptual self, I'm Judd, whereas the posterior cingulate cortex is an experiential kind of clenching or time stamp that links that conceptual self with events in the world, he said. So we feel like I'm the one who got angry in this situation. I'm the one doing this. Brewer has proposed that the posterior cingulate creates the experience of being caught up in our thoughts, feelings, and sensations, which corresponds closely with the Buddhist concept of grasping or attachment, identified as the cause of dukkha or suffering, and also that it may play an important role in drug addiction. He has gathered evidence showing that by toning down the activity of the posterior cingulate cortex, mindfulness can reduce nicotine cravings in smokers who want to quit. Clinical trials suggest it may also have a role in treating a wide range of other cravings, whether for food, drugs, or anything else we desire. See Chapter 7, Fire Worshippers. By contrast, the psychedelic psilocybin, the active component of so-called magic mushrooms, is not physically addictive, though it does have a dramatic effect on the two key nodes of the CMS. An fMRI study in 2012 by researchers at Imperial College London found that it not only quiets the medial prefrontal and posterior cingulate cortices, but also uncouples their activity. This may explain the egoless state reported by people who take psilocybin, in which the distinction between self and the rest of the world dissolves, evoking the profound spiritual experience of being at one with the universe. It is as if taking the drug temporarily short-circuits the brain's machinery for generating our sense of myself and everything else. Natural psychedelics have been used in traditional religious rites to channel the divine in much the same way that the Vedic priests in ancient India believed they could unite Atman with Brahman, the self with the supreme soul, through meditation. It has even been speculated that their trance-inducing ritual drink Soma was made from a type of psychedelic fungus. Crucially, the CMS, a part of a network of brain regions known as the default mode network, that become active when we're not focused on a particular task and our minds are wandering. Another key node in this network is the hippocampus, where the brain encodes episodic or autobiographical memories, recollections of things that have happened to us. By contrast, when we're focused on performing a task that requires our full attention, a constellation of regions known as the Task Positive Network fires up as activity in the CMS, and the mind-wandering network dies down. So it seems the brain has two opposing networks, one for handling tasks that demand focused attention, and another for self-reflection, musing about past experiences and speculating about the future. While one is activated, the other is suppressed, and vice versa. These findings accord well with the pleasurable experience we can sometimes have of losing ourselves in a task that absorbs our whole attention, whether it's a video game, motorcycle maintenance, or mathematics. This is the elusive sense of flow that musicians and athletes aim for, seeking their best possible performance. While we're in the zone and completely focused on a task, any meandering thoughts about ourselves fall away. You may also be familiar with the opposite experience, being so consumed by your thoughts you forget what you're meant to be doing or saying, perhaps becoming clumsy, making silly mistakes in your work, or losing the thread of a conversation. "Sorry, I was miles away," you say. The objective of mindfulness meditation is to notice whenever your attention starts to get lost in this self-referential maze of thoughts and bring it back to the breath or whatever sensation has been chosen as the meditative focus. Buddhists believe this trains the mind to appreciate that our sense of self is not a solid, unchanging thing, but is created when we latch onto whatever is bobbing along in our stream of consciousness. A term coined by 19th-century psychologist William James from a literal translation of the Pali word vijnana sota. The idea is that with practice one learns how to let go of passing thoughts, memories, and emotions. Remarkably, the neurological signature of this shift in perspective can be read in the brain after only 8 weeks of mindfulness instruction. When people who have taken the course are asked to focus their minds on moment-to-moment experiences as they lie in an MRI scanner, activity in their medial prefrontal cortex, one of the two key components of the brain's self app, declines significantly compared with control participants who haven't received any training. Interestingly, at the same time, there is greater activity in brain regions involved in body awareness and processing sensory stimuli, which, as we saw in the previous chapter, are also associated with the pain-relieving effects of meditation. What seems to be happening with mindfulness is that it shifts our focus away from self-referential thinking toward a more detached, moment-to-moment focus on bodily sensations and our environment. With dedicated practice, this altered perspective becomes more ingrained, so that the characteristic changes in brain activity are not restricted to periods of meditation, but become a permanent feature of waking life. In 2011, Brewer and his colleagues at Yale University found that the medial prefrontal and posterior cingulate cortices of people who had been practicing for more than 10 years were less active while they meditated in an MRI scanner compared with control subjects. Even when not meditating, there were distinctive differences between the two groups. In meditators, activity in parts of their brain involved a meta-awareness, the ability to think about thinking, and cognitive control rose and fell in conjunction with that in the posterior cingulate cortex, suggesting that its activity was being regulated in some way. The Buddha's teaching of non-self goes to the heart of what it means to attain enlightenment or nibbana, because understanding the concept is clearly not enough. To fully realize it and become free of the habitual I, me, mine of human existence requires many years of training the mind not to identify personally with every passing desire and emotion. It involves slowly erasing old mental habits and inscribing new ones into the hardware of the brain. Trainee meditators learn to notice when they are grasping at thoughts, emotions, and body sensations, and then let go, bringing back their attention to the present moment. Instead of thinking, for example, "I am angry," when this emotion arises, they are encouraged to say silently, "There is anger." In this way, they start to develop a more impersonal third-person perspective on their stream of consciousness. Far from being a mere philosophical, spiritual exercise, this decentering of the mind has a measurable effect on well-being, as we shall discover in the next chapter. Mindfulness-based therapies are proving their worth for reducing stress and anxiety and for preventing relapse in those prone to depression. Buddhists believe that our deeply ingrained sense of having an independent, unchanging self that miraculously stands aloof from everything and everyone else is not only illusory, but opens us up to all manner of suffering. A great 20th century physicist who famously tore up the rules of space and time reached a similar conclusion. In 1950, he wrote a letter to Robert E. Marcus, political director of the World Jewish Congress, whose son had recently died from polio. It was not a conventional message of condolence by any means. "Dear Dr. Marcus, a human being is part of the whole called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. The striving to free oneself from this delusion is the one issue of true religion. Not to nourish the delusion, but to try to overcome it is the way to reach the attainable measure of peace of mind. With my best wishes, sincerely yours, Albert Einstein." This is easier said than done, of course, but the evidence gathered by Brewer at Yale and others suggests that meditation might help us attain this happy state. It's tempting to imagine what an fMRI analysis of Siddhartha's brain would have revealed if scans were made at regular intervals in the 6 years following his abandonment of the comfortable home life, during which he followed a strict regime of meditation. Scientists surely would have recorded, as they have in the brains of today's committed meditators, that the parts of his brain involved in monitoring moment-to-moment experience and exercising cognitive control were becoming more powerful. At the same time, they would have seen steadily decreasing activity in Siddhartha's cortical midline structures, the regions most closely associated with creating the delusion of having a solid, unchanging self. after his enlightenment, Buddhist scriptures tell us that the man who had once been called Siddhartha Gautama began to refer to himself in the third person as the Tathagata, which literally translated means thus gone. He no longer clung to the impermanent constituents of his being in the old delusions of selfhood. Buddhists believe that by extinguishing the self, he extinguished suffering. To all intents and purposes, the man he had once been had vanished. Chapter 6. Golden Slippers. Hard it is to train the mind which goes where it likes and does what it wants, but a trained mind brings health and happiness. The Dhammapada, translated by Eknath Iswaran, verses 35 to 36. It was around 4 o'clock in the morning when the millionaire's son materialized from the darkness like a sleepwalker, wearing nothing but a silk dressing gown and a pair of slippers trimmed with gold thread.